the paper next week.
So, I did put some study notes on the Web CT. Yeah? Can people have a brief look at them? Did they try to do... anyone try and do the exercises that were there?
Yeah, a little bit.
There was a simple phenomenological exercise, descriptive type, you know, essentially the idea. I mean, put bluntly, try and see if you can come up with an example in your life, or an example full stop, you know, use your life if you have to, that you can read, interestingly, by which you mean find something new to say about it, or a new way of thinking about it, perhaps, on the basis of Klossowski's sort of ontology of impulses, or Klossowski-Nietzsche's ontology of impulses. And the second one was to do that sort of piece of exegesis. Yeah, so who did anything on the first exercise? Good. I saw the piece, I saw the brief discussion you had online.
With Sam?
With Felicitas, I believe.
Alright, yeah, that was...
anyone else brought phenomenological example pieces? No? Okay. And who brought exegetical bits? Anyone brought those? Or at least done some notes on the pages that you're meant to have done?
What some passages or?
Well, essentially the idea was to look at those, that 7 points, yeah?
I haven't looked at the 7 points.
Yeah, I mean when I say have a look, I mean actively have a look, with a pen and a piece of paper in hand. And that's generally. So yeah, 47, 48, yeah? So hands up, who's got any notes on that whatsoever? Not really? No, there we go. Luckily I brought a pile of notes on that section.
I tried to do what you said in the lecture last week, try and get an example and work it through the 7 steps, and I struggled with this. I took the example of being angry.
Good.
And I think I could only go to step 3 then.
Okay, well why don't we begin there, since we've got an example, and I think it's probably a good one. Sounds like it's got something tough to get our teeth into. So we've all got page 47, yeah? So we're all at least familiar with these 7 steps, these 7 points, which we can think of as what? How would you describe these 7 points? Should be fairly simple, but... I mean, obviously they're a sort of summary, but they're a summary of what? I mean, are they a deductive chain, let's say?
How something goes from an impulse to a sign is the transition, isn't what it's trying to do? It shows what happens.
Yeah, let's just look more formally, I mean. I mean, is it a deductive chain that we've been presented with, of 7 deductive steps? Who would say yes to that? Who gets to thought, who sort of things to think that there's a sort of...
It's more weird than that, I think. It's not...
Okay, so it doesn't feel like a deductive chain.
No, not entirely. But it does have a rhythm to it, it does have a flow that goes like this. But it's not exactly a deduction, in that sense, I think.
So if you were having to characterise what's going on here, is it just a what?
A description.
Hmm?
A description.
It's a description, yes, yeah, a summary, but it's a summary of what?
The process. Of how it all comes into being.
Maybe I'm being too obscure. I'm thinking in the sense of like a line of thought, okay? So you have a line of thought that sort of makes a series of steps. Now, in reason, we're obviously encouraged to use, you know, the strength of the deductive move as the basis for how we make each of those steps, and that's plainly not obvious here. But it's also not, it itself is not a description of something external. It's obviously a description of what's going on in the book. So it's a description of what we might want to call something simply like a line of thought. And the idea is, how do you then judge it if it's not deductive? How do you see whether it's right or wrong? How would you assess it? You know, because if in order to assess it, you're going to need to somehow work out whether a move that's made is acceptable or not. That's the whole point of the move. You want to sort of, as it were, see whether you can, you know, enact, see whether those moods work and where they take you. So how would you go about assessing something like this if it's not deductive and it's not just simply a description that is as it were, entirely judged on the basis of like the subject's description capacity? You know, in other words, whether you like the way they describe something or not, it's an aesthetic reaction to it. We don't want to necessarily have an aesthetic reaction to it. Do we like it or not? We want to have a philosophical reaction to it. We want to be able to deal with it as a sort of argument. A sort of argument.
Logic won't do for this, will it? It's not enough. I think you'd have to represent it, kind of experience it, in a sense.
Feel
it, work it in your life, maybe. I make it, live it, in a sense.
Right, okay.
Give your own examples to plug in.
Right, exactly. So this is the reason for just trying to push it. This is why you need, if you're going to really try and engage philosophically with this is what Skłodowski's arguing here, you will need to actually try and bring up descriptions of your own examples, because that's the nearest you're going to get to being able to sort of see whether it works, to be able to sort of, you know, use a lived experience. In other words, we try and use a lived experience to judge a description or an account of lived experience. You can't just, as you say, rely upon logic, although you can't discard logic either. But if you don't do that aspect of bringing up your own examples and seeing whether they work, essentially you're going to permanently be hobbling yourself when it comes to trying to assess a line of thought like this, because you'll have no resources with which to resist it. The only resources with which you can resist it, which is what you're doing when you're assessing something, you're in a sense resisting a line of thought. The only resources you're going to have to resist it are going to come from your own thoughts about practical lived experiences that you are familiar with and intimate with, that you can describe and, as it were, rely upon. And this is something we will come to perhaps later today. Rely upon that aspect of your intuition or sensibility, as Kant would probably call it. So, that's why I wanted you to work with this notion of examples.
So, Matt, would these then work as in a sense, sort of categories that are sort of like boundaries to your experience? You know, like how we had the categories that marry sensibility. So, therefore, you see if you take sensibility now and you see if it fits into this sort of description that you gave.
In a sense, yes. Yeah, in a sense, yes. I mean, it's going to be a little bit, less clear than in Kant, perhaps. But in a sense, the word you're looking for is consistency. Okay? Do they maintain consistency? Can they be maintained in a consistent way when applied in various different situations, various different lived experiences? And obviously, the way you test and use your own sort of lived experience to test that is going to be the ground for you making a philosophical assessment. In other words, you'll be able to then make an argument back at Skłodowski, Nietzsche, as to whether this works or not. And from the basis of it not working at some point, you can begin to investigate why it doesn't work. And only on that basis, really, can you engage on this terrain. Now, obviously, you can just dismiss this as it could be said more clearly, it could be said in a better way, it could be using a different style or method, that's all acceptable as well. But in doing that, in rejecting the methodology implicit in this, you're closing off the ability to actually test out how far this method can go. Okay, which is what you want to do when you're learning philosophy, see what a method can do. And so if you engage in imminent reading of this text, you're going to need to use imminent, in other words, you know, accepting for the sake of argument, the conditions and the methodology given by the author you're studying. If you're going to engage in imminent reading of this text, you're going to need to use that notion of lived experience. So I'm going to encourage you again to do that, because you will find it almost impossible to really develop an essay, particularly a critical essay, without engaging in that process. It's absolutely the first step to really beginning to critically think through Skłodowski in this situation. Obviously, you know, be able to read the book and understand what the hell's going on and the line of thought that you're meant to be critically assessing is obviously implicitly needed as well. We need to know that. We need to know what it is we're talking about, in the sense like, of being honest about it and being accurate as far as possible. But in order to critically assess it, we need this lived experience. So that's why I want you to do that. So if that's fairly clear to everybody, the imperative there, yeah? Okay. On the basis of that, then, let's turn my mobile phone to silence, number one.
That'd be hilarious break to the lecture.
Hmm?
That'd be hilarious break to the lecture. Mm. Oh, I'm
God, yeah. Yeah, it'll probably be some freaking Capital One or something hassling me for money.
you're the first director.
All
Ocean Finance.
Yeah. No, Ocean Finance. Don't own any property. Right, anyway, let's move on. So, we have at least one example today, which is the example of anger from Felicitas. So, why don't you discuss how that works and how far you got with that?
Okay. Right, so the first step, the tonality of the soul is a fluctuation of intensity. So, sometimes you're a little bit angry, sometimes you're very angry. So, there's a fluctuation or a difference in degree.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second step, the anger has to reach a certain intensity before you communicate it. So if you're just a little bit angry, you might just not mention it, but once it's reached a certain degree or a certain level, then you have to say something.
Okay, so, I mean, we're looking at... I mean, this is where we're beginning to encounter a specific situation, so... I mean, would you want to perhaps use a variety of descriptive words to sort of indicate the different degrees of the situation? For example, would anger go from mild annoyance to complete rage?
Yeah, it can do.
Okay, so if we sort of 0 degree of like just activated mild annoyance that goes all the way up through to complete rage,
yeah.
What's the difference then between this notion of like mild annoyance and complete rage? What's one of the most obvious things we might want to say, for example, if we were talking about the relationship of subjectivity in that situation? How is the subject when they are mildly annoyed or when they are completely enraged?
In a way, this kind of concentration. If you're mildly annoyed, you can just get on with it. If you're completely enraged, then it's more or less all-consuming, isn't it?
Right, that's a perfect word to use, all-consuming. So what's occurred at that point? Where's the subject?
It's lost.
It's not lost, because it's the subject that's, in a sense, being consumed, but where is it, in a sense?
Inside.
I mean, lost in a way of, like, literally, if you allow it to be lost in a fog, as it were, rather than disappear.
Well, the subject has become the rage or the anger. It's almost one.
It's almost one, it's like a possession, which is what he was talking about earlier. If you remember that quotation from over in the book, that notion of being possessed and dispossessed and possessed again. So what sort of word would you want to talk about, though? I mean, in legal situation, if you're completely enraged...
Oh, you have to diminish responsibility.
Right. So what sort of thing we're looking at then? The relationship of the subject, or how the subject is in the sort of... degree one, mild annoyance, to up to degree 100, complete enraged. What's one of the things that occurs to the subject?
Loss of control.
Loss of control. Now that sounds pretty important. If a subject is, in a sense, a control, a self-activating, autonomous thing, in control of itself, we might want to say, then how do we reconcile that with it being completely enraged? How can a subject be completely enraged if a subject is that which is in control of itself? Or does it just pop in and out of existence? Which is some sort of weird, sui generis sort of ex nihilo thing, you know, or the subject just is there or isn't there? I mean, how the hell are you gonna... That seems to me a rather bizarre idea of a subject.
Sounds sort of like bursting the banks of the subject. In terms of the anger event, you've got the control, and the anger eventually bursts the banks of
control. Well, that's one way of thinking about it.
Can you argue that you're always kind of possessed? I mean, you know, you're never free from kind of an intent, well, from a feeling, I mean, even if it's mild or intense, I mean, you're always... I mean, is there really that much of a difference between being totally enraged and being sort of a milder feeling? I mean, they both seem to dictate the way you will behave. So
okay.
I mean, is it really that you lose control when you become completely sort of agitated? I mean, were you even in control originally? You know?
Well, I'm not going to answer whether it's one or the other, because I don't know. But I think that's a good way of trying to deal with it. And what you're looking at there is, in a sense, saying, well, one description, this loss of control description, actually contains within it this presupposition that the agent is in control, whereas we could go back and say, well, the very idea of an agent being in control is what we encounter as being incoherent here, not the idea of the subject itself. If we then, you know, replace the notion of the subject as that which is in control of itself with the notion of a subject as somehow always a fluctuating intensity, we no longer have an incoherence in our concept of the subject. And that speaks for Klosowski's argument in terms of it producing a more coherent concept of the subject. Does that make sense to everybody? That's, in a sense, you could argue that's a strength of Klosowski's argument here, is that he doesn't encounter this paradoxical relationship in which we presuppose a subject is in control of itself. We then look at one simple analysis of a phenomenological experience such as anger, and we realise that there's some sort of weirdness going on here. So we can identify in that weirdness this presupposition in what it means to be a subject. Now, of course, removing from the concept of a subject that which is in control of itself is going to have huge implications, not least because, as we mentioned, this idea of responsibility. How would you achieve responsibility if you didn't have the subject in control of itself as a premise for a responsible sort of action? Okay, so there's a lot of things you will lose if you're not careful. Anyway, shall we carry on? Were you about to get to point three?
Okay. Talks of the intensity becoming a counterweight to itself, and therefore the intensity has to divide.
Mm-hmm.
So that could mean that when you've reached a certain level of anger, it turns against itself, all of a sudden it might become ridiculous. Or when you think about it, it's, oh, actually, maybe I shouldn't be angry about it because it's completely ridiculous. So that becomes the counterweight to it. And this is, in a way, the division of it. So anger becomes its complete opposite. And we also talked of the waves, so the anger becomes
I think in terms of what you're saying there, I want to describe it more as the appearance that of myself in being angry. The appearance obviously produces a sort of counterweight because I suddenly appear to myself as stupid. Is there anything specifically in just the affect of anger itself that could be produced as a counterweight? Again, I think shame is something that is connected further to appearance, how I appear to somebody. You know.
What do you mean by counterweight?
Well, okay. What do you think you mean by counterweight?
Like it's an antagonist. They're antagonizing something, but I don't know exactly how or what.
Antagonizes is not necessarily the right way of putting it. I think. I mean, what is a counterweight, strictly speaking?
Something that balances.
Right, something that balances, yeah. Something
like an exhaustion.
That might be a sort of the anger in that when we sort of say something like an anger burns itself out. You know, if it just pushes it to that might be a way of encountering it as a counterweight. Well, a counterweight. One of the best ways of thinking of counterweights is when you have pulley systems. So you can, you know, you have the platform and then you have this huge weight, and of course if you step on the pulley system and just unbalance it just enough, it will gently drop you down. And you balance up a series of weights that can then move quite enormous forces. I mean, the forces that can be moved with counterweights are phenomenal. It's one of the principles of engineering and one of the absolute fundamentals of human techniques. Absolutely fundamental is that we have a sort of an intuitive relationship to counterweighting. And once that's sort of established, from sort of Archimedes and those people onwards, you can build enormous structures and move enormous forces, far, far more than the ant can. And all that sort of strange things when people say, well, the ants physically, you know, can jump 25 times what a human can. You know, well, you know, it can't lift 25 times its own weight using counterweights and rebalancing forces, you know.
That's how I'm sure the ants is complete.
Yep, exactly.
Another really interesting fact about ants in the day, apparently if you pile all the animals in the world together, like, the pile of ants would be bigger than all the other animals put together.
I'm not sure that's a very interesting track, but I can sort of see why it might stick in your mind.
Say one thing to tell you.
What were you going to say, Dana?
It seems to kind of be saying it's sort of trying to, or it's aiming towards an equilibrium. But I mean, I know that Black and Red, the rest of the book saying that the power of what's behind intensity can't tolerate an equilibrium.
Yeah, I mean, here I don't think he's aiming at an equilibrium. I think he's talking about this relationship between sort of forces, such that you're looking at at least two ends, like a seesaw type situation at the very minimum, or a pendulum, or a counterweight structure in a lift, or something along those sort of lines. So you're looking at a system which has at least two points, as it were. So the equilibrium is not necessarily... I mean, the system that has two points can be in a state of equilibrium or a state of disequilibrium, but either presupposes it's got, like, as it were, two points.
Yeah. So it'd be kind of transitory equilibrium. It might reach a point where it's... but it'll always be continually fluctuating.
Well, I think that's Nietzsche's, Klosowski's Nietzsche. I think that's their ontology, is that the idea of it ever reaching full equilibrium is only sort of an idealistic notion of death or entropy or something like that.
Yeah.
Would happiness be being counterweight then to anger?
No, we're looking. I mean, it could be taken to be, but we're looking, when we say counterweights, at something imminent to the intensity itself, not another intensity necessarily. Although they will be related, as you were talking about, in terms of appearance, they will be intimately connected with sort of other intensities and produce different relationships to them. But try and always look for what in that intensity itself could be taken to be a counterweight. Don't assume that an emotion or a force is singular. In other words. That's what's being suggested here. No forces are singular. There is no such thing as simple and singular anger. Not only there are degrees, but it operates in this situation of coming into existence at the point at which it has a counterweight. And this notion of at least two points in the counterweight system is really what's important. Two points of force. So there's
both from the same intensity?
Both from the same intensity. So you can think of them as the highest and the lowest points. That's one way of thinking of them.
It could be resignation.
Well, resignation is the production of another intensity, but you see what I mean? So yes, you could produce, we can see that it produces, so what is it that produces resignation? Because obviously other things can produce resignation as well, tiredness, illness, etc. So looking at the production of certain results, and so it's trying to, this is why it's difficult, so we don't usually have the words for the intensities of this sort of situation. But we do have the descriptive capacities in novels, in literature, in films, in our own experiences of encountering these various moments. And obviously the idea is that, this sort of text, the idea of this sort of text is that it is going to enable you to be better skilled at encountering those things in life. Better able to encounter them. Better able to notice that they're there. If you didn't even realise or think that that might be the case, then obviously you're not going to notice, as it were, two things going on at once in an intensity.
But in an anger, is it that the anger subsides or you try and inhibit it? I mean, it reaches a peak where it's just uncontrollable, then it just kind of drops. But
some people it never does. Some people never lose their temper, do they?
Yeah. Why is that the case?
Control. They're trying to gain back control, so it's from the anger. So when you lose anger, you lose control. Mm-hmm. I suppose counterweight could be
that
you're trying to gain it back.
And that's a sort of counterweight as well. I mean, that's right. So we're looking at, I think, what we need to clarify is there's two types of counterweights. A different intensity that's produced and reacts back, or a different intensity that's already there and is transformed, as it were. So the intensity of the appearance, the intensity of control, it can be transformed by the intensity of anger. Or resignation produced and folding back. So two intensities. But also bear in mind that within an intensity itself, the idea is that there is something like a double force going on, this counterweight movement, a wave, a fluctuation. And so anger itself is going to, as it were, go from, precisely as you sort of thought about, from a zero degree to a high degree. And in a moment of losing your temper, there's almost going to, the idea would be there's almost going to be more than one element of that anger, you know, kicking around. You encounter, sometimes you encounter these sort of things when you find people talking about sort of, you know, ideas of righteous anger, perhaps. Mm. And so the anger is sort of proud of itself.
Just cumulative.
I was going to say, yeah, self-justified anger is like pleasurable.
And the pleasure of anger, of course, as well, is another thing. Yeah. Obviously, you know, a boxer would not be a boxer unless they found some pleasure in anger. Mm. That just seems to me to be self-evident, self-evident as the cogito.
Is that one intensity or two enmeshed coming together?
Right, pleasure and pain, right. That's, I mean, those are going to be taken almost as criteria here. So, yes, I mean, that's a difficult thing to sort of suggest. Everything, in the end, is an intensity itself.
Yeah.
So each time we name it and conceive it, we're naming it and conceiving it as a sort of intensity, but mustn't conceive them as singulars, as sort of a simple thing. So they're always complex. Mm. Yeah, it doesn't make you feel like you can get a good grip on anything, does it?
But are they complex, or is it that our interpretation of them is complex? Is our, yeah, our meanings of them that we attach to them is complex?
We'll have to get to that point probably in a couple of
issues.
Mm, we will get to that issue, but probably not this week.
Okay.
Do you want to continue, Flisters? Okay, so this is where you were saying you got stuck after point three. Right. So let's get to point four then. Everyone's sort of happy so far with point ones to three?
Yeah.
Using that example, right? Sorry. So, point four. But does an interpretation, which results from this counterweighting, as it were, presuppose the search for a signification, rise and fall, these are designations and nothing else. Is there any signification beyond this observation of a rise and fall? Intensity never has any meaning other than of being an intensity. In itself, the intensity seems to have no meaning. What is a meaning and how can it be constituted? What is the agent of meaning? So that's your question, right? The point to note here is obviously he's posing the problem. As you said, you bring it up, we're going to hopefully get to it and discuss this problem of the relationship to meaning. But the crucial sentence to note there is what, would you say, in point four?
Rise and fall, these are designations.
In itself, the intensity seems to have no meaning. Yeah? So he's making what looks like an ontological claim. Why is it to be... Why do you need to be cautious?
Because it says in itself. How would you know?
No, so there's a crucial word there that you should be very cautious of.
Seems.
Yes. Okay, so he's making an ontological claim, but he's making a sort of speculative or hypothetical status claim about ontology. He's not sort of saying it is, simply, you know, but it seems like that. Why does it seem like that? Because of the account he's so far been giving of Nietzsche. Okay, so it seems like that on this account.
He's being a bit cautious.
He's been cautious. I mean, in one sense, it's very simple. He's just indicating that, you know, if we take it at face value, this ontology of forces, we universalise it so that everything is an impulse, everything is just a rise or fall or a wave of fluctuating forces, then we have a nihilism with regard to meaning.
On page 39 to 40, there's a bit on this, that's the only one that we really find like an
impulse. Oh, good, okay. Right, exactly. I think that's a very good location for that. So you're thinking where it starts first, yeah? Okay. After that paragraph about machinery.
Yeah, from time immemorial.
Yeah, okay.
Really.
Oh, yes, right, it's a nice quote from Nietzsche there. And, I mean, in a sense, both the paragraph before and the paragraph after are going to sort of help fit into that issue of meaning. Now, one of the things I'd like to indicate to you in the paragraph just before in Klazovsky is this, and this is one way of thinking about how this problem of meaning is going to rise. The problem of meaning is going to rise through something like, something we might want to call the problem of the automaton. Okay, so about halfway through, let's read this paragraph. First, one must admit everything that is purely automatic. To dismantle an automaton is not to reconstruct a subject. So in admitting that there, or suggesting that there's this ontology of forces, we're sort of suggesting an automatism. You might think of this as determinism or a sort of natural law or whatever, but essentially the idea is sort of automatic machinic operation. And if we dismantle it, the idea is we're not sort of trying to find a space for a subject that's not an automaton. Okay, we're not trying to just sort of simply doing that. Since perspectivism is the characteristic illusion of this automaton, to provide it with the knowledge of this illusory perspective, the consciousness of this unconscious, is to create the conditions of a new freedom, a creative freedom. So this is one of the things that we're going to look at today. The idea then here is relatively simple, that somehow self-awareness of its own productive capacity, in other words, the fact that it has perspectivism, that it sort of produces a perspective and not a truth, not in a sort of out of this world, not a truth in the sense of a transcendent position truth, truth for everybody from, one point. Encountering its own productivity, encountering its own fictionalisation, etc., being aware of this, is going to produce something else that he calls the conditions of a new freedom, a creative freedom. Conditions of a new freedom, where he says there the condition, this sort of encountering self-awareness about your own productivity of the perspective.
Where is it?
Sorry, 39, from the paragraph first. Right. First, one must admit everything. Second sentence. Now, I just want to sort of skip over in the next couple of sentences and go to the sentence that begins, to recover an authentic spontaneity, the producer of these categories, the intellectual organ must in turn be treated as a simple automaton, a pure tool. By consequence, as a spectator of itself, the automaton finds its freedom only in the spectacle that moves from intensity to intention and from the latter to intensity. So in other words, what he's talking about in that paragraph is that if we encounter ourselves, this intentional being, the meaningful being that is the subject, as producing perspectives involved in the production of how we see the world, we also encounter ourselves as somehow engaged in a sort of stupidity, as it were, a sort of game in which we compose, on the one hand that the world has no meaning, on the other hand that I can produce any meaning whatsoever, so we've got sort of 0 degree to full intensity, any meaning whatsoever. And in sort of moving between these various meanings, we actually encounter this idea of the spectacle that moves from intensity to intention and from the latter to intensity. So it just happens, moves to it happens for a reason, moves back to it just happens. The reason's just something I invented. And so you don't stop at any of those positions, but you encounter a sort of game of meaning production. And in doing so, you encounter the fact that the game is, as it were, capable of being remade. You can make the rules anew. Creative freedom.
What relationship does this have to language?
Well, obviously it's very intimately related to language. I mean, intention is going to be found primarily within the Code of Everyday Science. Yeah. Encapsulated, as it were, or expressed in the Code of Everyday Science.
So we put place boundaries on that, though? Because of the words that are limited, but not experience won't be in that sense.
But words don't limit, yeah.
Words don't limit.
I never understood that argument.
What about?
Well, they don't seem to me to have any great sort of ability to stop you remaking them, redescribing them, redefining them. I don't understand why you know, word limits in that sense. Now, word limits, if you don't try to redefine it, if you're not aware of that capacity to redefine it, of course they limit you, in the same way that if you're not aware that there's a door in your room, you don't know how to get out of it. Well, obviously, if you don't think there's a door, you think it's just four walls, you're stuck, you know, well, there you go, obviously. But if you realise there's a door, it's pretty simple and obvious that you can walk out of it. I mean, you know, it doesn't really have any great, you know, difficulty to work that one out. And as far as I can see, the same with words.
What about the law of contradiction then? The law of non-contradiction, sorry. I mean, would that kind of limit us? Would that be a limit to this creativity in that sense? Would that be a limit to...
What does the law of non-contradiction actually say?
Something can't both be and not be. No, that's the law of
expression.
That's
the law of non-contradiction, A and not A, but how is it first posed by Aristotle? It's not posed as a sort of formal law, it's posed as a result of a situation.
Can't be and not be.
What can't be and not be?
Something.
Yeah, right. What is it that grounds Aristotle's account?
I want to go with all men is mortal thing, but I don't think
that's
there.
No, not all men is mortal thing.
I can't remember.
Right.
Hmm? Someone can't speak. A and not A. In other words, we don't know what they mean if they say this, if they do this. It makes no sense to us. Doesn't mean they can't. Obviously they can physically enunciate the words. It does, you know. So he's not saying they can't speak in the sense in which their mouth doesn't work if they try and do that, you know, but he's saying that it doesn't make sense to us.
So ground of communication then.
So, well, for that, essentially what he's saying there is not that you can't breach the law of non-contradiction. He's saying if you breach the law of non-contradiction, you also breach the conditions of sense. So that's what he's saying. That's what the law of non-contradiction really says. It doesn't say you can't do it, because that just, I mean, that's just such a... I mean, how on earth can I not do this? Obviously I can do this. I can go, you know, I am and I am not am. I'm here, I'm not. I mean, it just makes no sense to say I can't do it. What it means is it makes no sense to those people listening. The words breaking out of the game. And so the condition of sense is the law of non-contradiction for Aristotle.
But that sense, is that your sense as well, or just somebody else's? Say I answer the contradiction, can it make sense to me? And obviously,
what
makes sense to you already
establishes
that. Can it make sense to me?
Well, if you're Aristotle, obviously not. I mean, we can take that as read. Aristotle is plainly going to think not. Most analytical philosophers would probably agree with him and think not. If it can be said, it can be said clearly. It's one of the principles of analytical philosophy. Now, if you begin from this hypothetical ontology that everything is essentially an impulse, including words, they're just impulses, then essentially sense is also something like an intensity of an impulse. Now in that situation, the conditions of sense are not structured by linguistic relations of A and not A. They're structured by what is possible as an intensity. So the very conditions of what is senseful, full of sense, what makes sense, is going to be found in a different space. So this is why the methodology is what's crucial to realise is different in these type of philosophers. The very, you know, what the conditions can be found, where the conditions for things can be found, is going to be different.
That's huge. That's a complete abandonment of ontology then. You kind of, the ground epistemology of ontology is supposed to be the other way around.
Hmm?
So basically your epistemology, what you can know, is grounded on the ontology of impulses.
Yes.
So therefore you can't really flip on its head that can't do the race.
No, this is utterly incapable of being assimilated to the epistemological move of Kant. No, totally.
Completely antagonist. Yeah. That's quite huge. Interesting.
What they don't throw out from Kant is this continual look for transcendental conditions.
Yeah.
So they're still looking for the conditions of something. So if we're looking for sort of what is sense, we will look for the conditions of sense. So we then need to work out, well, where are we going to look for the conditions of sense, how sense works. We can either look for it in language and say, well, sense is a product of language, in which case we've got a sort of problem of accounting for, well, how the hell did language just, you know, was it just pop into existence? Is it just sort of imprinted in your brain, like, you know, natural grammar? Is it innate? Well, where did it come from, sort of thing? Whereas in this ontology, the advantage is going to be, well, Language itself results from impulses. Sense is just a set of intensities which themselves result from impulses. The conditions of sense, therefore, are going to be found in an analysis of impulses and their intensities. Now that is, in one sense, straightforward and clear. In practice, incredibly difficult to try and pin down and work with, which is why the other methodology of epistemology comes first. What you know you can say about the world is the limit of what you can say about the world. Why that, in a sense, is sort of more attractive, because it can be spoken, it can be clearly assessed on the basis of a game we're already playing. Here, we're faced with a situation of trying to sort of work out how we came to be playing a game in the first place that we weren't even aware we were playing. Now, how we sort of came to be here in the first place, in a situation in which we've always been here for a bit. It's not like we're sort of at the first moment ever.
It's more genealogical, isn't it?
It's much more genealogical in that sense, yes.
Good.
Okay, so are we sort of hopefully making a little bit of progress just in seeing some of those connections here? I think what I want to do next is take a brief break, and then I will run through again, essentially focused on these points, these 7 points, and I will run through some reading notes more as a sort of exercise and show you what I want you to be trying to do. And so I'll run through the reading notes, you can then sort of we can discuss them as we go through, but they're sort of an example, and I'll put them up on the website as well so that you can sort of see what sort of things I'd like you to be trying to do.
Is it on the web CT, this stuff?
Yeah.
So I haven't seen the sort of discussion boards. It might be a problem with my computer, actually.
On the left in the menu.
Oh. Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
Yeah. On the left in the menu, there's a link to the discussions. Usually most of the other stuff will be linked through the front page, but yeah, it's always a good idea to check through some of the folders on the left. They sort of drop down.
Sometimes that sidebar menu is...
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes it's clicked over to the right, to the left, and hidden, with just icons.
I think I've seen it.